As President Trump prepares for his second term, the preliminary numbers show $4.5 billion was spent on political TV and radio ads this year, and healthcare was front and center.
The healthcare messaging this year, there was a lot about cost specifically, that about lowering cost. And so maybe not surprisingly, you have partisans of both sides of the aisle attacking the other for high costs related. That also relates to economic considerations and inflation, of course, but there was a lot of discussion of healthcare costs specifically.
Kamala Harris knows what it's like to be middle class. It's why she's determined to lower healthcare costs and make housing more affordable. Donald Trump has no plan to help the middle class, just more tax cuts for billionaires. Being president is about who you fight for, and she's fighting for people like you.
I'm Kamala Harris, and I approve this message.
Our guest is Erica Franklin Fowler, who holds a doctorate from the University of Wisconsin and is the director of the Wesleyan Media Project, which tracks political ads. She also focuses on analyzing health-related communication,
specifically in House races, but I think there even were some in Senate races that used transgender issues to make similar lines of attack against Democratic candidates, basically saying, you know, the Democratic candidate is for they, them, and we are for you.
This is Conversations on Healthcare.
Dr. Franklin Fowler, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah. Now, I noted in your most recent report, and I say recent report because I know this gets updated pretty regularly, but it showed some interesting data points. 18% of all the ads were focused in on healthcare, 28% of them were pro-Democratic, and only 7% pro-Republican, and 10% of all ads were about abortion, 20% were pro-Democratic, and the Republican ran zero ads on the topic. I'm wondering if you could share with our audience, what does this tell us right now?
Yeah, I think it tells us that healthcare broadly is not polarized. I think both parties care about it, but certainly abortion specifically is a very polarizing topic, and Democrats are talking a lot about it. And Republicans really don't know how to message on that particular issue at the moment.
Well, Erica, we're all living in Connecticut, you and Mark and myself, and your chart shows our media market only aired 21 presidential ads in total in mid-October, compared to Philadelphia, which had 36,000 ads in the weeks before Election Day. So for those who did not see the healthcare spots, what messages were they sending about abortion, prescription drugs, and healthcare for the undocumented people?
So you support giving universal health care, Medicare for all, to people who are in this country illegally?
I am opposed to any policy that would deny in our country any human being public health, period.
Are you for defunding the police?
How are you defining defund the police?
It's actually wrong and backward to think that more police officers will create more safety.
We need to get rid of money bail.
Convicted, in prison, like the Boston Marathon bomber, on death row, people who are convicted of sexual assault, they should be able to vote?
I think we should have that conversation.
I am prepared to get rid of the filibuster to pass a Green New Deal.
I have always supported Medicare for all. I was very happy to sign on to Bernie's bill, and I give Bernie, frankly, a lot of credit.
There's no question I'm in favor of banning fracking.
Do you ban plastic straws?
I think we should.
Yeah, so very different sets of messaging. And I can also describe how the messaging has changed over time, if that's useful. But for residents of Connecticut, we didn't get a lot of presidential ads. What we saw were essentially the national buys. So when either presidential candidate purchased an ad that aired everywhere, basically, whereas residents of battleground states were getting inundated with a ton of advertising, not just on television, but also on their mobile devices, at the gas pump, you know, anywhere they have a screen. The healthcare messaging this year, there was a lot about cost specifically, that about lowering cost. And so maybe not surprisingly, you have partisans of both sides of the aisle attacking the other for high costs related. That also relates to economic considerations and inflation, of course, but there was a lot of discussion of healthcare cost specifically, and then some discussion of Medicare premiums as well going up. I think Donald Trump aired some ads attacking the Harris campaign for increasing Medicare premiums specifically. On the abortion side, there was obviously a lot of Democratic messaging about concerns over women's rights, the Republican candidates up and down the ballot supporting national abortion bans and or taking away women's reproductive freedoms. So those, I think, were the main topics. With respect to immigration, there was a ton of messaging on that this year. A lot of it, the healthcare related conversation within it was about fentanyl and fentanyl coming across the border and securing the border that way, which is very different than the prior messaging that we used to see on opioids and concerns over opioid use.
Well, certainly in the mix of all of those ads, and perhaps the TV spot getting the most attention, is President Trump's anti-trans ad, the so-called they-them ad.
Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners.
Surgery.
For prisoners.
Every transgender inmate in the prison system would have access.
It's hard to believe, but it's true. Even the liberal media was shocked Kamala supports taxpayer-funded sex changes for prisoners and illegal aliens.
Every transgender inmate would have access.
Kamala's for they, them. President Trump is for you.
I'm Donald J. Trump, and I approve this message.
There are reports that the Trump campaign and others spent over $120 million airing this ad, oftentimes during football games. I wonder if you could tell us about the commercial and its impact.
Yeah, it also aired a lot during the World Series. And so,
right.
Definitely it was a very prominent spot. It got a lot of free media attention, not just the paid advertising that the Republican campaign spent on it. I think one important thing to note, too, is that it echoes lines of attack that are not just in the presidential race. There are other Republican candidates further down the ballot, specifically in House races, but I think there even were some in Senate races that used transgender issues to make similar lines of attack against Democratic candidates, basically saying, you know, the Democratic candidate is for they, them, and we are for you. In most cases, those ads go after transgender surgeries and support for transgender surgeries. The language is something along the lines of, from the Republican perspective, is something about we're protecting children from, you know, life-altering transgender surgeries. But it also leans sometimes also into biological men being in women's bathrooms and women's sports, which you find sort of a combination of one of those three, sometimes all three in Republican messaging. And that is definitely a topic. We saw some of these attacks in the 2022 cycle from Republicans. Democrats mostly do not talk about this issue. They didn't talk about it in 2022, and they didn't do it again in 2024.
Well, you know, it's so interesting around healthcare. There's healthcare and there's healthcare coverage, right? And we go back to the memorable 2008 campaigns, the Affordable Care Act, right. You know, the 12 and 16 repeal, replace, now enjoying unprecedented popularity as a part of the American healthcare system. But I don't think I ever saw that in the polling or in the ads that were out there. It seems like for both protecting it, the Democrats would have put more emphasis on it, and the Republicans, you know, continue to kind of shy away now from repeal, but saying they're going to make everything better. What did you see happening within this domain in terms of healthcare coverage and the Affordable Care Act?
Yeah, it's a great question. And this is an issue that we've tracked extensively over time because some of our first analyses were tracking the Affordable Care Act. What's interesting, so Democrats, after they passed the Affordable Care Act in 2010, sort of ran away from the issue. They didn't talk about it for basically a decade. The Republican messaging on healthcare was much more prominent in the early 2012, 2004, 2016, and it was all about repeal and replace. It wasn't until the 2018 cycle when Republicans had tried, right, to repeal the act. And turns out that a lot of the provisions of the Affordable Care Act are very popular, mm-hmm. that Democrats finally found, oh, OK, perhaps we should come back and talk about pre-existing conditions and other sorts of things. And so we had the Wesley Media Project actually had dubbed the 2018 election as the healthcare election, because there was such a prominent focus from both parties on healthcare, because Republicans couldn't run away from it entirely. They were trying to defend their votes and defend, you know, like say that they were for pre-existing, you know, protecting pre-existing conditions and other things. We sort of expected 2020 to be another healthcare election. COVID, obviously, although it was clearly a health pandemic, had an interesting interaction in that, because there was so much economic disaster that occurred that it was both healthcare and the economy sort of shared the advertising attention that year. And then, of course, the Dobbs decision has sort of shifted the healthcare landscape to talking more about abortion. I would say that, you know, I think abortion restrictions are very unpopular. I mean, there's a lot about healthcare that works in Democrats' favor because of the popularity of a lot of different types of provisions. And what's interesting this cycle is you had a lot of abortion amendments passing in states and even some really conservative states that also went for Trump. Right. And I don't know if that is potentially indicative of residents sort of buying the Republican line of argument. Trump actually said this explicitly, you know, like, well, I send it back to the states. And so there may be some indications that the population thinks that making, you know, amendments to their state constitutions will protect them from potential abortion bans. Whether or not that pans out is to be determined.
Well, it has in a couple of very conservative states. And so maybe they got the idea that it was coming to them, might be ill-formed. And, you know, I want to go back to your earlier answer about the efficacy of ads. And I noted the New York Times carried a piece before the election day that said Democrats won the ad war in terms of dollars spent. Since they lost, I think you've already sort of opined a bit about the effectiveness of TV ads. Is it over or diminishing? But I guess I'd also like to know, if you had to spend money, would you spend it on advertisement or get out the vote campaign? I mean, have you looked at, you know, what's the best investment that one could make in a campaign?
Yeah, all good questions. I mean, I think a campaign has to do all of the above, right? So since we've been tracking television advertising, which, you know, the Wesley Media Project started in 2010, we have data that go back a decade earlier than that, to 2000. But since 2010, every cycle, everyone has predicted, you know, is this the year that television ends? And we really still, I mean, even this cycle, although it's not a historically high year for television, because 2020, when folks couldn't campaign in other ways, television sucked in a lot of that additional funding. Television is still important. It's still an important way to reach mass audiences, and especially older Americans who are more likely to turn out. But the television advertising is really for the persuasion public. It's not, there are some get out the vote ads, but they're mostly to try to persuade the undecideds. That doesn't replace your sort of campaign strategy to also try to mobilize the base. And so digital advertising, actually, which has seen really large increases, especially this cycle, the Harris campaign, we haven't totaled all the dollars yet, but early in the cycle, they came up and said, you know, that they were already committing $480 million to digital and streaming, which is, you know, that was mind blowing. And they definitely had advantages, especially on the Meta properties, so Facebook and Instagram, relative to the Trump campaign. Google and YouTube, it was tighter, but they also had advantages there. The advertising that happens online there are two purposes. So some of it is traditional persuasion that looks like more like what you would see on television. But then there also are donation appeals, trying to get people to they're trying to raise money so that they can spend more on advertising. And then there also are get out the vote, advertising at the end. But the get out the vote is also going to be through door knocking and, you know, phone calls and other sorts of things. I think campaigns ignore one of those strategies, persuasion or mobilization, at their peril. So they're going to do both. And so I think the answer is more of all, right? So part of the reason why we see increasing amounts of money going to elections is because there are increasing number of platforms and ways to try to reach citizens, and campaigns try to do more and more of all of those things.
Well, we can only imagine the media industry was very happy with the elections just for the sheer volume of business. But Eric, I want to give you a moment to perhaps go a little bit hyper-local and generational. There are lots of polls and a lot of feedback about how young people were voting. You're on the campus of Wesleyan University here in Middletown, Connecticut. You're surrounded by young people, probably have a few work-study students with you to analyze data. Sure. and a lot of engagement with faculty. What did you hear from young people relative to the election, and how did it stand in contrast or similarity to what the national polls were saying?
Yeah, so I mean, our campus and President Michael Roth here is really been pushing democracy initiatives, trying to, you know, like reach our constituencies here and ensure that they're engaged in democratic practice and all of those things. And so I think, you know, the Wesleyan student body tends to be pretty politically active generally. I do think this cycle, you know, speaking about the headwinds, was challenging for young voters for lots of reasons. I think there are a lot of young people who are concerned about democracy and concerns about democratic backsliding. I think there also are a lot of, you know, concerns about the war in Gaza and what is happening there. And that has implications for the Biden administration and the Harris campaign, frankly, because of their involvement in the activities over there. And so I see a lot of different you know, students in my classes would be students who are already sort of very interested in politics. Hearing from some of them, you know, I think there's a varying interest in politics. There is some level of disengagement, I think, more broadly among the youth population, in part because the politicians of both parties have historically been so aging. That dynamic shifted, I think, when Harris entered the race, but maybe isn't completely replaced, in part because, you know, there still are a lot of issues that aren't necessarily being talked about that are really important to younger voters, including climate, for example, right, that doesn't get maybe enough attention.
Mm-hmm. You know, I want to connect the dots here. You were talking a little bit earlier about the million spent on digital ads and then sort of where young people are. And this was also an election about podcast, right? So you had Trump really very focused in on the Joe Rogan experience, and he was on 6 Feet Under and this past weekend with Tao Van and others. And I'm wondering how you're sort of dealing, how this has come into, this is a sort of new experience or new data point for elections, right? Where there was a real strategy on the Trump campaign to make sure. Now, Harris got out to a few places, but really not the depth that it seemed that President Trump was engaged in. How are you assessing the impact there of these broadcasts that were out there?
Yeah, I mean, I think notably the Harris campaign went on Call Her Daddy, right, which was another one of those that has a large audience, notably a female audience, right, in contrast to the Rogan experience. I think so. Those types of events are there has always been a strategy of presidential campaigns finding innovative ways to try to talk to voters. So if we go back to the 1990s, for example, there's a reason why Bill Clinton took his saxophone and went on late night TV.
Sure.
Right. So the campaigns are looking for audiences. Most Americans, and this is true across the board, and in fact, it's one of the things I say to all of my media and politics students the first time that they show up, is I say, by definition of you being here, you're not the average American. Most Americans tune politics out, frankly. It's not that they're not interested, it's just that their lives are busy and it's not, you know, top of mind and top priority for them necessarily. And so campaigns know this, and they have always, sort of going back to the innovation of modern campaign and modern campaigning, are always looking for new and different ways to try to reach voters in places where they might not always hear from politicians. And so I would say that both the phenomenon of the podcasts and going on podcasts it's a new tactic, but it's an old, strategy of campaigns. And
but is it the engagement there? I mean, you get the shout outs, the tweets by Taylor Swift or Beyonce, but these podcasts are really about a long conversation with people over a wide range of topics versus just, hey, I've got celebrities lined up and they're doing, a one-off for me. But the podcasts seem to have more texture, engagement, drawing people in, which is their job, right? Because they're looking to have an audience and a meaningful one. So, it does seem to be a somewhat of a shift here.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a different format, and certainly a longer format allows politicians both to, convey to citizens that they are more knowable, maybe, than they...
Because they're talking about sports, they're talking about other things. They're not just talking about, hey, I'm here to give you my spiel and,
Right, exactly. And I think that is in line with, campaigns that have gone to entertainment-leaning programs. To include late night TV, but also, daytime talk shows and other sorts of things. Those strategies are always beneficial to a campaign because it shows a different side of the candidate than you would get through a more formal setting. So, yeah, I mean, I think the exposure that candidates get from those settings can be really important. And you're right that the longer format and the way in which some of those, the three-hour conversation in particular, enables a much lengthier look at a candidate than most citizens get in any other format.
Well, Erica, the election is behind us, and that means it must be ready to get ready for the midterm elections, right?
Get very little break, unfortunately.
Coming right up, very little break. And I'm curious, as we look forward, and based on some of the comments, to the degree to which people tuned out much of the political ads of the presidential election, I'm wondering whether there is a strategy to maybe put forward some of the younger members of the administration, and certainly some of the people proposed for high profile posts or that the president says he'll appoint are not shy about being on camera, have a long history of being in the public eye. Do you think there'll be more use of people in other positions in political ads than just an aging president going forward for the midterms?
Yeah, for sure. And I do think, already if you watch as many ads as we end up watching, and there are thousands of them on television, and then, many, many, many more on digital, they do often feature younger people just by their nature. They're trying to, convey to a wide variety of residents that, the candidate is for people like them by featuring people like them. So definitely, I think that will continue to be a strategy. And then the other one big feature that both campaigns use is bringing on, your model citizen to convey, support from a particular constituency. So in the context of healthcare, that can often mean doctors and nurses are showing up in advertising to convey their support for a particular candidate or their concern about a particular problem that's not being addressed. And both of those things can be effective in terms of conveying what is at stake, basically. Mm-hmm.
That's interesting. Maybe individual providers are resonating, but if you look at the institutional view of the CDC, of the Department of HHS and the like, those are really underwater significantly. And I'm just wondering, in terms of the public health, how are we going to get very important health messages across to people when there's been such an undermining of the traditional go-to healthcare organizations that are steeped in science, and yet people are saying not going there, not believing them.
It is a real challenge. And that is something I work with a collaborative on media and messaging for health and social policy. And this is something that we care deeply about, because the polarization and politicization of health related messaging has tremendous and important and sometimes life altering consequences. And so I do think it is really important for us to be thinking about how, you know, medical and public health and CDC level guidance is perceived and taken in, and how do we communicate about those topics in ways that build back up trust is super important. So thinking, I think, first about leading first and foremost with values, and I do think that individual messengers can be more important and helpful than the institutions themselves. It's important that the institutions are trusted too, but part of the way that we can get there or sort of try to build back is about the messenger and about the sort of leading with values. Like, we all care about health of society and health of our children and those sorts of things. And I think leading with messages like that are super important.
Well, Erica, you mentioned the Collaborative on Media and Messaging for Health and Social Policy. We'd love to have you take a minute to talk a little bit more specifically about your work on advancing health and racial equity. Tell us what you're doing in that area.
Yeah, so the Collaborative is a three-institution organization. So we have Wesleyan is part of it. We sort of direct the media tracking hub. We also work with researchers at Cornell University that lead the sort of media impact hub, and they do messaging experiments and tests and other things. And then the University of Minnesota hub is our dissemination and engagement. So between the three institutions, we've done a fair amount of work, both talking and listening to healthcare communicators and health communicators more broadly about what are the challenges that they have seen and what are they facing in this more polarized and politicized climate. And some of the questions that have been asked in that setting are about, you know, do we talk about health equity? Do we talk about race? Do we talk about, you know, these different issues, and how do talking about any of those things affect the perceptions and the impact of the messaging that we put forward? And then once we, you know, have gathered that information from the practitioners on the ground, our goal is to take that back and try to work on messaging that can help move policy forward in a productive way. So what we've been working, some of my colleagues have been working on messaging about the child tax credit. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that is, it has been super beneficial of lifting people out of poverty. And one of the questions is, you know, can we talk about the child tax credit in a way that specifies who the beneficiaries are without a sort of a backlash effect from other citizens? And it, at least the preliminary evidence suggests that, yes, there is a way that we can talk both about the universal benefits, but also the targeted benefits of the policy without backlash. And so those types of research evidence, I think, can be helpful in bringing back evidence to the people on the ground about how to talk about policy in ways that improve and increase support for policies that we know improve health and racial equity.
Thank you, Erica, for joining us. And thanks to our audience for being here. Just a reminder, be sure to subscribe to our videos on YouTube. Find us on Facebook and X with our account name CHC Radio. And as always, you can go online to chcradio.com to sign up for email updates. And please also feel free to share your thoughts and comments about this program. Take care. Be well. Thank you again, Erica. This copyrighted program is produced by Conversations on Healthcare and cannot be reproduced or retransmitted in whole or in part without the express written consent from Community Health Center, Inc. The views expressed by guests are their own, and they do not necessarily reflect the opinion of Conversations on Healthcare or its affiliated entities.